Hi everyone, Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to Top of the Morning on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. After a week in which investors had to digest disappointing news on jobs, unexpected policy personnel developments, and higher tariffs, the markets bounced back handedly, and this week the focus will be on the July inflation data and geopolitical developments. Joining me here today in studio, glad to welcome back Jason Draho, Head of Asset Allocation for the Americas with the UBS Chief Investment Office. Jason, nice to be back with you here at the table. A lot to talk about, so great to have you here. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Dad. It's good to be here in person. It's a beautiful summer day in New York City. It's not hot and sweltering just yet.
But, you know, the week is young. I think the temps are going to rise as the week goes on, so we'll see. But I know, Jason, since you and I last spoke, we did see some interesting developments in markets. Let's start with the market performance last week, which did seem to be immune to market risks. So why do you think that happened?
Well, think about a week ago this time, we would have been talking about what happened the prior week, where we got a July jobs data that was below expectations, largely because of revisions for prior months. You know, a real downgrade there. There was concerns about trade deals not being reached, and therefore tariffs would go higher. In some ways, like unexpectedly, like larger amounts than investors were assuming. The questions about Fed independence, questions about data independence, because of the President Trump had fired the head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So a lot of things that the markets could worry about, and yet here we had it, the S&P 500 was up 2.5% last week. The NASDAQ 100 was up 3.7%, sits at an all-time high. So the markets and investors looked at it, kind of yawned, and said, thank you very much, it's summer, so I guess things are all good. So why is that the case? I mean, given these factors going on, you know, kind of in some way, big picture, when we see the markets, we always have to think about, like, they're moving relative to what investors expect, you know, not, you know, just in terms of absolute news, but relative to what's expected, presumably what is already kind of being priced in the markets. And by and large, I think investors, I think, are reasonably confident that the economy and policy will ultimately be able to kind of thread the needle. And by that, I mean, it's almost like kind of Goldilocks in a twisted way, where investors expect growth to slow, they expect the labor market to slow, and they expect inflation to go higher due to tariffs. So as the data moves in that direction, it's sort of like, well, this is what we expect. The markets are kind of pricing that in, and therefore it moves in that direction. It's not that surprising. So I think, you know, that alone, sort of, you know, softness, disappointing on the data side, you know, disappointment in terms of moderation, that's not going to be enough to really kind of scare the markets. And likewise, now that the economy is softening, the labor market's softening, the markets can be confident that the Fed's going to cut rates starting in September. And so it's a little bit of, you know, threading the needle, like, kind of weakening, but not too much. It's also the case, I think some investors, are at least maybe interpreting the jobs data a little bit optimistically. Because if you look at the month-over-month, you know, changes, you know, after the revisions, you know, in May, it was around 19,000 new jobs, June 14, July 73. So it's like, oh, some people say there was initial hit due to tariff uncertainty. Now you're going to get some more trend level job growth. Again, it's a, you know, glass half full interpretation. There's also thought that, you know, part of what's going on is, you know, immigration crackdown, deportations, you're going to get slower job growth. Right. It's not a sign of fundamental weakness. It's just labor supply is shrinking. So you're going to see some of that as well. And so you add all this up, investors think you're also looking through near-term weakness because they'll think 2026 will be better. You'll get some modest fiscal stimulus from the big, beautiful bill. It's also expected that the negative impact of tariffs will play out the rest of this year. And then next year, from a base level effect, you start to kind of move forward, especially with inflation. And consistent with that, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent gave an interview with Nikkei Asia over the weekend. And in it, he said that, you know, he expects trade negotiations with countries yet to secure a deal should be broadly concluded by October. So again, consistent with investors kind of looking through some of the tariff uncertainty, some numbers go up, they expect some of those things to come down. The effective tariff rate should still be around, you know, 15%. It's sort of logical that the administration would want to do this by October because 12 months later, we have midterms, right? So you want to kind of get this resolved. So then you have a good, you know, positive economic momentum going into the midterms. I think the investors are kind of hanging their hats on that. You know, can this play out? So again, you know, it's kind of, to me, it's a bit of threading the needle. And there is certainly scope for disappointment in the near term.
Now, the market does seem to be, Jason, shrugging off the weak labor data. But how do you interpret the current state of the economy? I know we have a key inflation print coming out, I believe, tomorrow morning, right?
That is correct. We get the July CPI data on Tuesday, then we'll get the July PPI data the day after. From that, we can impute, and economists can impute what the PCE data, inflation data, will be, which is what the Fed officially looks at. And that's usually a pretty good gauge of where we're going to go. So what I just laid out in the, you know, the prior kind of answer was, investors expect growth to slow, inflation to go up, but ultimately feel, you know, relatively comfortable about the fundamental story and things look better in 2026. That's roughly kind of, you know, our view. But I wouldn't be quite as sanguine or so maybe dismissive of some of the near-term risks. I mean, it's clear the job market is weakening. It's not just of, you know, quirky seasonal patterns. What we see is, in terms of these revisions, we had significant downward revisions in the May and June data. The historical pattern is that in the summer, the revisions tend to be more to the downside than the upside. So chances are, if July will be revised, and it's probably going to be revised lower more so than higher. So this upward trend is like, that could be, you know, when we get the data in early September, that could be kind of wiped away, that no, actually things are not quite as good as people think. You know, just as for reference, there's estimates like what is sort of a sustainable level of growth based on sort of demographics, immigration, like how many jobs do we need to be created in a month in order to maintain sort of an equilibrium or status quo of the unemployment rate. And it's somewhere around the 75 to 90,000 range, you know, give or take. The last few months, it's been running at 35,000. So it is below trend. And there is concerns that you get to stall speed where if job growth and hiring, you know, gets low enough, then there's uncertainty about the economy. People, you know, slow their consumption. Hiring slows, and you kind of tip into kind of a maybe mild recession in that case. So that is, you know, not our base case, but that certainly, you know, is a possibility. On inflation, the consensus for the July CPI data is about 30 basis points month over month for core CPI. That's what matters most. You know, it could be, you know, plus or minus a few basis points. If it's something closer to 50, that will be kind of surprise into the markets, but it's likely that the tariff impact is still coming through the pipeline, and there's, you know, evidence and data would suggest it's going to build ultimately. So when we get the August data, it could be, you know, 0.5% month over month from then until year end, which would bring your core CPI data up to around 3.5%, you know, from 2.6, 2.7 right now. It's likely to be transitory, but again, until we actually see it play out, these are the risks. So we're confident, relatively confident on the medium term outlook. But I think, you know, a little bit more, you know, cautious in terms of, you know, we need to see the data to actually, you know, kind of, you know, be confident in that view. And we're going to see sort of the implications of tariff coming more evidently in the next few months. I think the markets might be a little too comfortable on that front.
Now, another factor top of mind for investors in recent days, the personnel, unexpected personnel developments over at the Fed. We did see that President Trump nominated Stephen Miron, currently serves as chair of the Council of Economic Advisors, to replace Adriana Kugler as a Fed governor. So what impact could this have on Fed policy, Jason?
So Kugler, I think officially, you know, her last day was last Friday. So her Fed, you know, governor seat is vacant. And like, this has happened before. You know, sometimes you get sort of vacancies and it takes a while for them to be replaced. That was the case a couple of years ago where some of these seats sat empty for months on end. The assumption that I think a lot of economists had was that she was set to resign or, you know, be off the board by January, that the Trump administration would nominate someone for that seat. That seat would be the Fed chair sort of in waiting. That was the presumption. And they might, you know, they move relatively quickly, but not within days making sort of announcement. So the initial reaction would be Stephen Miron, then the Fed chair in waiting. I think the shorter answer is no. I think they wanted to get someone in place, you know, relatively quickly, someone who would be, you know, dovish. I think, you know, he will, you know, he's been a critic of the Fed in the past, but also probably someone who would argue for Fed rate cuts. Does it really change in the near term what the Fed's going to do? I think it's unlikely. First, there's a question, you know, will he be go through Senate hearings and confirmation to be on the FOMC, you know, by the September meeting? You know, possible, but certainly not a guarantee. Even if he is, you know, our base case is that the Fed will cut in September. The market pricing is at about a 90% chance. We do get, well, the CPI, you know, data for July tomorrow, but then we'll get one more month of basically of August data, of employment data, sales, inflation that the Fed will have when they make their decision at that point in time. I would also watch for what Fed Chair Jay Powell says at the Jackson Hole Central Bank Symposium. That takes place, you know, August 21st to 23rd. The Friday is the 22nd. That's when Powell, at usually roughly around 10 a.m., gives his speech. It's often a time when the Fed governor kind of gives an indication of what policy will be in September. Powell's done this in the past. So you could use that as a kind of laying out what they intend to do and sort of hinting, you know, using language that the markets would interpret. Okay, they're set to cut, barring something kind of really surprising. So Miron's appointment doesn't really kind of change the trajectory. We think that ultimately the Fed will cut, simple way, like 100 basis points by Q1 of next year. Market pricing right now is 90% chance for September, about the equivalent of 2.3 cuts by December. And by the end of 2026, a little over 5 cuts. So does it, you know, it probably doesn't change much, you know, whether it's Mearn is appointed or not. What it does do is means that there'll probably be some time as the Fed interviews candidates. Then they may announce Mearn's replacement, by later in the summer. Or they could keep him on and sort of wait. This will be kind of the path going forward. But I think this should not be viewed as a sign of like he will be the next Fed.
Keeping the options open.
Also, maybe could be from the administration, sort of like nominate someone, see how the markets react.
Right.
Is this a view as a dovish signal? Is it a view as like, a Trump lackey who will just do what Trump wants? Given that I think the way they were sort of framed as, it's a temporary, placement until, January. And it was sort of surprised, like he was not on anyone's, betting odds, or kind of list of, potential candidates. So it was sort of, surprising to see that name is thinking, would he be Fed governor? So I think the markets would probably look at it that way. So if the Trump team was kind of thinking like, let's see if we nominate someone like this, how does the market react?
Right.
The markets may not view it as like, this is not necessarily who we think is going to be the Fed governor, so we don't take it too seriously.
Very interesting. We'll see how it plays out. Another unexpected market development last week, Jason, was the clarification that imports of gold are subject to tariffs. We did see some market movement around this. So what does that mean for the outlook for gold from here?
Well, there's more movement today in terms of that development. I'll get to that in a second. But basically, the idea is that there's a memo kind of essentially went out saying tariffs on certain imports of gold, applied, and they actually applied effective like April 2nd to Liberation Day. And specifically, it's gold imported that it's like, 1 kilogram and 100 ounces, which is roughly 4.12 kilograms. Gold, these gold bars, they're not exempt from U.S. tariffs as previously thought, whereas 400 ounce bars remain exempted. And those are actually accepted by ETFs. Now, there's reports this morning that there'll be an executive order soon from the administration that will be used to issue or kind of clarify misinformation about sort of tariffs. So the presumption in the marketplace is that this is going to be the tariff exemption will apply to these ones, the 1 kilo and 100 ounce gold bars. Otherwise, like, what's the point of issuing an executive order to clarify? Like, you just reiterate what's already saying. Which is why you saw the price of gold. We're seeing the price of gold down like around $1.50 as of this morning. Now, keep in mind that a big percentage of the imports into the U.S. Come from Switzerland. The tariff rate on imports from Switzerland is 39%. So it's not just a 10% tariff. It's actually a 39% tariff on gold because Swiss refiners are their main intermediaries for the global kind of gold value chain. They process roughly 50 to 75% of all newly mined and recycled gold. So if the U.S. is importing it, it's primarily from that market. Mm-hmm. If it turns out this executive order doesn't announce that that gold is exempted, there's a good likelihood that the U.S. gold future premium relative to gold traded outside of the U.S., that premium will keep rising. At an extreme, it could be that reflect the full, say, 39% tariff on imports from Switzerland. That would imply a premium of more than $1,300 an ounce in the U.S. versus ex-U.S., or given kind of current spot prices, means the price of gold in the U.S. would be $400 to $700. Now, we don't think that's going to go that extreme, and ultimately the tariff will probably be exempted. I think stepping back, big picture, does this change our sort of overall kind of bullish view on gold? The short answer is no. We expect, we have a price target of $3,500, which is, not that much higher than the current level, about 3% higher. But from my portfolio perspective, we think it remains a good, diversifier. Demand remains underpinned, for that reason. Like, investors of different types are buying it. You've seen central banks continue to buy it. In view of rising government debt, inflation risks, the central bank purchases, there's a demand for gold. So ultimately, irrespective of this tariff story, we think it's a good diversifier. If anything, if there is for U.S.-based investors, if the price were to rise to $4,700, that's not a bad return, but that's not what we're expecting.
Well, appreciate that clarity, Jason. Mm-hmm. So before we wrap up, do you want to spend some time on overall asset allocation? What should investors be doing right now?
Well, a couple things I'd highlight. Right, we had a brief spike of volatility, roughly 10 days ago. Markets kind of rallied. The VIX, fell down to like below, 14, rose back up to 20, back down to around, below 16 right now. We think there's going to be more volatility as the data comes in. Again, things are kind of in the summer lull right now, summer calm, but we know the fall, early fall, September, October historically is a volatile period. So near-term volatility, but medium-term we remain, you know, constructive. We talked about sort of the economic environment that we think will be kind of a soft patch, but ultimately better. It's also the case that, you know, the stock market is not the economy. I think the earnings season is kind of reflective of that. We're about 90% of done of the second quarter earnings season. And what we're kind of see is that like 73% of companies beat on EPS or earnings above the historical average, 78 beat on revenue. The historical average is 60. So good kind of results overall. Since earnings season started, the third quarter earnings expectations have been revised higher, modestly, 10 basis points. But 90% of the way through an earnings season, typically that's down 2 percentage points. Mm. So relative to typical patterns, it's a 2 percentage point, you know, improvement in the earnings outlook. So again, sort of reflecting sort of the relatively good fundamentals. Now, a lot of this is being driven by, you know, the Mag 7. The Mag 7 grew earnings by 26%. And this does not include NVIDIA, which reports later in August. The rest of the S&P 500, the 493, their earnings grew, you know, 4%. So when you think about all this, you know, the stock market is not the economy. There's a strong AI secular tailwind. Mm-hmm. It's why we like the tech sector overall. It's why, you know, this is, we think that basically the bull market for equities is intact, even if near term there is some volatility. Switching over to fixed income, one thing I'd want to highlight is that our team has put out a note last week recommending long-dated munis, meaning 15 to 30-year munis, are more attractive than treasuries of similar maturity. If you look at the performance this year, munis have underperformed. It's been most significant at the back end. There's been a lot of supply, you know, coming to the markets this year. The curve, this muni curve is steep, so you got all the math works out that as we move forward, you got a lot of kind of roll down. So certainly if you're in a high tax state, and I think I'm a resident of a high tax state.
Likewise.
That these are particularly kind of attractive at this point in time. And even if, you know, you're not a high tax state, just given how the market overall has performed, you know, they become quite a compelling opportunity. So generally speaking, we're saying, you know, shorter maturity, you know, we think yields could kind of back up a little bit. But if you're looking to lock in at the back end of the curve, long end munis in particular for buy and hold investors look quite attractive right now.
Well, Jason, thank you for going through those positioning considerations and updating us on a range of developments, very fluid, though top of mind for our listeners. And do, of course, look forward to continuing the conversation with you next week, especially as we receive more clarity on the inflation situation.
Exactly, yes. And gold as well.
Definitely. Thank you, Jason. Appreciate it.
Welcome. Have a great week.
You as well.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/working with us. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.